Good morning, everybody. As usual, first question, do you have any questions? Did you come across questions when you went through the slides, looked at the slides, and thought about what I told you last week? So, to see where we got. I think we made it until here. So last slide was a comparison between the one-time pad and the anonymity property of the DC network, right? So here we had what the attacker might tap. We had keys, which if you change the value of the keys, change the plain text here, the message. Or in this case, if you change the key, you change who did, or you can change who did send the message. Right, so this was the last slide last week. So do you have any questions to this slide or the slides before? Okay, apparently not. Then I gave you many, many options what exercises you might do as homework. Did anybody prepare some homework and has some questions or wants to discuss it? No questions? No? Okay. Okay, so what do you need? Do you need a table, how to add hexadecimal characters, or? Okay, mod 16, first you have two options. One is you say the keys, let's use the example A with B and B with A. The two keys are inverse to each other. This is, I think, how I did it. And then the operation, how you connect message and keys is always the same. You take just addition mod 16. One possibility. The other possibility is that you say, hey, I'm getting the same key or taking the same value of the key, but in one situation I'm adding the key and in another situation I'm subtracting the key. So first, these are the two possibilities you have, that is encoding the operation either in the key or in the operation itself. So where did you encounter problems? Okay, so if you like, put it on the table and we will see how far you get and where the problems arise. If you like.
So what I did was I converted them to decimal.
Decimal? First?
Well, that's what I did. Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe that's the first error. I'm not sure.
No, you can do it. It's only a question how many steps you want to take.
Okay. So for A, the message would be 191 then.
The message would be this value. So if you take the first four bits, hexadecimal means you're taking four bits, right?
Okay, so that's
So now comes the interesting point. Are you intending to add it up here? Or do you want to convert from here to there?
I'm not sure anymore.
Because, just to make sure what the problem might be, here you take four bits each, you transform them, and now if you add them up, maybe I take colors, you add up this and get a result. And this has nothing to do with what happens here. If you write it that way, obviously, you took these two together into one number. Now, if you add up the numbers, you get something as a whole.
Yeah, sure.
But what you would need is the two parts separately. So, if you go to decimal, what you might do, then you need two decimal values to keep them separate. Add them up and then do it mod 16. So maybe this was your problem, I would suspect. Okay. If you didn't do small errors in the arithmetic, probably this could be the fundamental problem to encounter.
Okay.
Okay?
So when I take the keys for B, the message for me is pretty simple. And the key for A, how do I arrive at that if I
What properties should the two keys have? They should have the property, if you add them up, the outcome is zero, right? The outcome should be the neutral element. So you are looking for a hexadecimal digit, which if you add two and this digit, yields zero.
And that should be C, D.
Because it's D, E, F. No, not sure. E, E, F.
E, yeah.
So it should be E. And then now if you add two, then it's first F and then zero and...
Okay.
And for B?
B5.
So B, C, D, E, F, zero.
Okay,
five.
Okay. Yeah, now I got it.
Okay. And maybe now we abort it, because now it gets, in some sense, not really interesting anymore, because now it's okay, you have to do it to an end, but these two things are important.
So I hope you see what difficulties might arise, or do you have any further questions? So maybe I should just give you a clearer view on the blackboard. So problems are clear. So if you go through the decimal representation, then of course you have to represent each hexadecimal character separately and add them up separately. And the second thing was, what is the inverse key? So you define it character by character. So the inverse character should be the character, if you add the original character and the inverse character, it should be zero. Okay. Sure. So your question is about? Slide 20, okay. So this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that in the microprocessors, there are two ways of file transmission, right?
Yes.
Why file? Because at first, there are already file transmissions by file stations.
So what is your question? Why do we have five informations here colliding? Or are you asking, why do we need overall five transmissions of information? This, so three, four, five. So what is your question about?
Yeah, there is one, but I don't understand how do you define the transmission.
So your question is, why do we need, after all, five transmissions, that is four retransmissions, right? This is your question?
Yeah, because I think, you see, at the beginning, the file message already be sent by pair of different stations. So I think this is a file transmission.
Okay. So let's do it step by step. So here we have five stations. Each station tries to send a message. So it's added up by the DC network. So what you receive in some sense is the sum of the message, or the messages. And if you wouldn't have a strategy how to reuse it later, we could just say it's garbage. Because usually, if you get the sum of many messages, and let's assume the messages are end-to-end encrypted, then what you get is just garbage. It's not useful. What I told you is that we can make good use of this by just making sure that four of these five messages somehow are transmitted, and then you can use the sum of the five messages and the four messages we are going to learn later, just to calculate the fifth message. So this is what we will finally do here in the very end. So what do? We have five stations sending. Maybe within the DC network, there are even more than five stations, but I only depicted those stations which really did send. And now we need some kind of procedure making sure that neither all nor none of the stations will send in the next step. So somehow we need a procedure to split the group of sending stations in two sets which are non-empty. The criterion I used in this protocol was that I said, okay, let's calculate the average message, the average, yes, the average message, and take the criterion if the message a station has to send is more or equal than the average message, then send immediately. Otherwise, wait. This is a procedure just to figure out if five stations want to do something, who should go ahead? And here I say, if your message is small enough, then go ahead. If your message is larger, then please wait. So we do that recursively because here we have again a collision of three messages. So we repeat the procedure, and here we in fact get a single message. So we can receive the first message. Then so here we would say, if your message is small enough, go ahead. If it's larger, please wait. So after this transmission, those waiting in principle would transmit. But there's no need to do so because this message we can calculate. Just take the difference between these two. And therefore, what is depicted in blue is just a calculation step, not a transmission step. And then, again, we take the criterion who should go ahead, who should wait. Then somehow we have finished here the subtree, so we go back, take the difference here, split, take the difference. So this is the procedure. Okay?
I have another question. In this scheme, we have with n messages, we have to retransmit n minus 1 messages. Yes. I don't think this is a great achievement because we can, after a collision, just send these n messages one after another, and that would work also by this complex scheme.
First, after this collision occurred, we do four transmissions, not five. So if we just would throw it away, what we would need is five transmissions. So in any case, we are saving one. Secondly, if you have a transmission or a collision of several messages, how do you manage to make sure that if you just say, let's retry, that you don't get a collision again? And there's some traffic models about multi-access channels and what kind of throughput you can achieve. And you have the following dilemma. If your channel is mainly not used, then you have nearly no collisions. So usually, whenever someone wants to send, he just sends and it's okay. But this only works if only a very, very small fraction of the channel is used. Now, if you start to increase the sending rate, the utilization of the channel gets better because more stations are using it, but the collision rate is increasing. Now, if you still increase the sending rate of the stations, you come to a point that when you increase it further, throughput is not increasing, but decreasing, because now mainly you're producing collisions. So, what do I say? If I have several collisions, then this means at the moment many stations want to send. So how to manage that a collision doesn't repeat? If the channel is not really loaded, nearly nobody wants to send, then what would happen? One station would send, and it would be finished after one step. So this kind of protocol, this kind of, as you call it, complex protocol, is mainly needed if collisions occur with a frequency that we cannot just ignore them. So, and to tell the story quantitatively, I think if you just have a policy that stations send whenever they like, the maximum throughput you get is not one channel capacity, but one divided by 2e, 2 times e. E is 2.7 something. Okay. If I look into your faces, I should write it down, and then probably you have the feeling you know what I'm talking about. So 2 times 1 divided by 2 times e. So this is what you get. And if, in some sense, we are slotting the channel, that is, we make sure that if messages collide, they collide fully. If you have a completely asynchronous channel, messages could collide just by the last bits of the first message collide with the first bits of the second message. Now, if you make sure that all the messages are of equal length, and so they start at the same time, then you get a maximum throughput of 1 divided by e. So you get a factor of 2 in throughput by just organizing when messages start. But still, this is well below using the channel to 50%. It's 30 something. So people who think about how to use a channel usually say, this is not enough. We want to have a multi-access protocol which achieves, if stations has a lot to send, a throughput close to 1. Whereas if you do it just in a random fashion, you never get close to 1. Okay? So, further questions?
I came up with the question, what would happen if an attacker would know the key between two bodies of the
server?
And I think if there are 3 bodies at all, the attacker can find out easily who did send the message.
I would say this depends on the key graph. So if you have 3 stations, and each of the stations did exchange a key with both other stations, then if the attacker just finds out the value of one of the 3 keys, he doesn't learn anything. Sure. Later we will have a proof that it's not possible, but okay, give your example and show your strategy, how you find it out, okay?
Has the K AB. I say it's the same.
Okay.
And ATC. Okay, and the attack now, for example, this key here. So, and so you know this key too. And if,
which effectively means that now the protocol isn't changed, the attacker knows the key, he can subtract the key from the output of the participants. What essentially means that I could just get away the keys, those two keys.
Okay, but let's proceed. Okay, now I say now, if there's a message sent over the network, the attacker would know the port which comes from A. Is this right, that he can know that?
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. He knows the output of A, he knows the output of B,
yes.
And he knows the output of C.
And now the attacker could say, well, with a high probability of one third, A has sent zero message.
Why does he know that this is with one third? It could well be that two of the stations sent a message, or none, or whatever.
Yeah, I assume that.
So I assume
exactly
you assume
one
the third. Okay.
Exactly one station did send a message, and there's no.
Okay.
Not two stations.
Okay.
Sent
okay. Let's assume it, and in some sense, it's an assumption, but okay.
Yeah. And so, now he knows that MA is 0 plus KAB plus KAC. And if that would be the case, he knows that key, and he knows that, and so he can calculate KAC in that case.
Yes.
So, and now he goes forward and says, okay, MC. He, in his assumption, he also sent zero, and this is KAC plus KBC. This he has calculated here, and now he calculates this here. And in the last step, he can check if MB is the message he knows plus K. KB plus KBC. And he already knows this and this, and now he could check if this is right, the last part. And if this would be not right, so I think MB could not be the sender of the message. B.
Why would you argue that way?
Because if B would be the sender of the message, the last criterion
okay.
Must be required.
Equation. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you do at the abstract level? You say, I assume that the outcome of the CRON is exactly one message.
Yes.
And in some sense, I make a distinction who I guess the message, which station the message did send. I guess it, so I have mainly with n stations, n cases. So, and then I do some conclusions. Okay. So, probably, if you say you do it that way, the outcome will be, it's okay. MB did send the message. But what you could do is, now you take the same keys and you assume MC did send the message. You do the same conclusions and you arrive, okay, MC did send the message. Or you do it the same way for MA. And then the outcome is MA did send the message. So what did you achieve after some while? You say, hey, I checked for consistency,
yes.
And all the versions are consistent. And I would say this is great.
And so mainly, if you say it's one message, it's three stations, if you make the assumption everybody sends the same amount, then the probability that one of the stations sends it is one third. Okay. So you got? And in some sense, what you just did is a very nice, let's say, example for what I said at the abstract level. I said, let's go here, that here the difference between the one-time pad and the DC network is that with the one-time pad we have what the attacker sees, we have the key, and that's it. And here in the DC network, this key value is repeated here. So in some sense, we have not only to make sure if you see this, then you can't conclude what the message is, but in some sense, we have to check consistency in the sense that, okay, if you take this key value here, and so on and so forth, then it's consistent. And this is just what you checked. Okay. So, putting it the other way around, why was I so certain that you hadn't a counterexample? Because usually in mathematics, if someone comes up and says, I have a counterexample, people get cautious, right? at least they should. So, what is the idea? And maybe I try to make some kind of drawing with the example. We had stations A, B, and C. And we have keys, right? Between those two, and those two. And now your starting point in your argument was that you say, I assume the attacker knows one of the keys, which in some sense was nothing you really used here. In your argument, you never said, I assume the attacker knows one of the keys, right? Okay. But let's assume the attacker knows one of the keys. Then this means all these stations calculate their outputs. So the keys, the key the attacker knows, makes it into the local sum. So in some sense, we can subtract the key. So what would we achieve? So let's assume the attacker knows the key between A and B. So he can subtract the key. Then he gets a description of the system where this key just is not existent. And now I have to argue why in this scenario the attacker doesn't learn anything who is sending. And why is this the case? This key here gives us an opportunity just to shift the message from here to there. So let's assume this is the message sent. Then I could choose the value such that the key is just, the key value is just the output value of this station. Then this station has sent something or that. So any key gives me a possibility to interchange who has sent the message. So this key gives me an interchange possibility between A and C. this key gives me the same between C and B. And so I could shift the message from here to there, or vice versa. So it's fully okay as long as the key graph is connected. The original key graph had connectivity too, in the sense that you have to delete at least two links, two arcs, before the graph gets disconnected. For example, you could delete this and that. And now this graph is disconnected in the sense that A is left alone, which means A doesn't share any keys. So if A is sending, the attacker could observe it. So since I knew that in the example, we had a key graph of connectivity 2, your initial statement, okay, if I assume one of the keys is known, I just said, okay, no problem. We have connectivity 2, so one of the keys values can be given to the attacker. It doesn't change anything. And therefore, I just said, okay, so I want to see your counterexample. Okay, so this was the key graph we originally had. Any questions? What we just discussed comes in a more systematic fashion now, because we are approaching somehow the proof, and it will come more systematic now. But first, you had an example, and any more questions towards that? Okay. So how do we prove it in the general case? And what is, and maybe first, what is to be proven? In your example, you started that you said, hey, I have a result, and I assume this is the message sent. So my result is sent by one of the stations as its message. This may be the case, but in some sense, you don't know. It could be two stations which want to send a message, and the outcome is just the sum of two messages. Or it could even be three messages, because each of the three stations, A, B, and C, wants to send a message. Then it would be the sum of three messages. So if you want to handle this kind of general case, we have to say that we want to show that everything could happen as long as the overall sum stays the same. That is, you do not only want to have an argument that instead of A, C could send the message, or instead of C, B could send the message. You would just like to have a more general statement that A, B, and C could send any set of messages. That is, A could send a message, B could send a message, C could send a message, as long as the sum of their messages is the global sum. So this is a general case, and this is what we want to prove. And of course, it covers the situation that one of the stations is sending a message as a special case. Okay. So our proposition is that if stations Si are connected by uniform randomly distributed keys Kj, which are unknown to the attacker, by observing all outputs of the stations, the attacker only finds out the sum of all the messages. Nothing more. And since he does only find out the sum of all messages, in particular, he cannot find out what particular message values have been sent, and he has no way to find out who did send which particular message value. So this is what we want to prove. So we're going to prove it by induction. So we start and say, if we have only one station, the proposition is trivially true. Because if you only have one station, of course, this station cannot exchange keys because there is no other station. So clearly, sender anonymity is not really overwhelming if you only have one potential sender. Okay. But if this station sends, the attacker only finds out the value of this message. And he did know well before that if a message is sent, then it's this single station sending the message because there's no other station. Okay. And now what we have to do is to do the induction step, that we have to prove that if our proposition is true for m minus 1, then we can argue that it's true for m as well. And this is what we are going to do. So let's assume I have stations here, S1, S2, until finally Sm minus 1. So let's assume our proposition is okay within this set. So this was the proposition, and here we just started the induction. So let's assume our proposition is true for this set of stations. And now we additionally take another station, Sm. Now, in some sense, we have to prove that the proposition is true as well for this larger set of stations. And now, to prove that, we could either use more complicated mathematics, which I don't do, or we could, in some sense, simplify our key graph. This is what I do. Going back, maybe I go back here. If I want to prove something for this situation, and if I say, hey, dealing with three keys is too complicated, probably for all of you it's obvious that if I say, hey, I'm proving what I originally want to prove for a situation where I'm telling the attacker one of the key values. So if I can prove what I want to prove in a situation where the attacker knows more than in the original situation, then I'm on the safe side. And here, such a situation is somehow tricky, because if you consider that as a system of equations, you can't solve it, because from any station to the other one, there's not only one path in the key graph, but in this case, two paths, which means connectivity 2 instead of connectivity 1. So what I would do is, for example, give the attacker the knowledge of this key and then try to prove it. And this is what I do in the general case. That is, I assume that my proof will only be needed for key graphs of minimal connectedness. That is, of key graphs which haven't redundant keys, which haven't redundant links. They are connected, but only simply connected, or minimally connected, as I termed it here. Minimally connected means if you are deleting another key, your key graph gets separated. The set of stations gets separated. It's no longer connected by keys. Putting it the other way around, having a key graph which is simply connected is enough for anonymity. Therefore, my strategy will be tell the attacker all keys I don't need. Let's assume we have another example because the three is only a very small example. So let's assume we start with the key graph D, E. So let's assume we have those stations and links. So now it would be a complicated set of equations, of linear equations. Could I do it simpler? Now I could say, okay, I'm telling the attacker additional keys. For example, I tell him this key. I could tell him that key. And now we see this is minimally connected, because if you're deleting this key, E is isolated. If you're connecting this key, D is isolated. If you delete this key, D, C, E are connected, but they are isolated from A, B. If you delete this key, B is isolated. So this is the meaning of, I assume, a minimal key graph. Okay? So is my understanding of minimal something you got? I hope. So if we now have a minimal key graph, this means there is at least one station which is only connected to one of the other stations. If there wouldn't be such a station, somehow it would mean we would have a circle. And if you have a circle, it's not minimally connected, because in a circle you can delete one of the links. So there's, in a minimally connected graph, there's at least one station which only has one key shared with the other stations. And now, to make the proof as simple as possible, I assume that SM is this station. I assume that SM does only share one key with the rest of the stations. And let's assume SM shares a key with SL. Let's call the key K. So what will happen? What is what the attacker will see? He will see that SM calculates its local output, its local sum. And OM will be the message of M, MM, plus the key. Because there are no other keys shared with SM, this will be the output. What happens at the station SL. SL will calculate its local output, OL, as the message station L wants to send, ML. Because I assumed here the key is added, I assume here the key is subtracted. Plus, maybe SL has some other keys exchanged with some other stations within the set where the proposition holds. What the attacker observes, according to our attacker model, is the output of all the stations. So the attacker gets O1, O2, until finally OM, which we just calculated. What we now have to prove, what is the proposition for M, that for any combination of messages, M prime 1, M prime 2, M prime M, which has the property that if you add up all those messages, you get the global sum. That for all those combinations, there's exactly one compatible combination of keys. This is what I want to prove. And mathematically, since our key, if you did tell the attacker as many keys as possible, still to keep the graph connected, there's now a unique path, and the set of equation now has a single solution. So, how do we prove that? We may assume that within this set and without the key k, the proposition holds. And now what we have to do is to reduce the case where we have a station Sm to the case Sm minus 1. So let's assume we want to prove that. So M prime 1, M prime 2, M prime M is any combination of messages with the property that the global sum is OK. So I want now to show that there's a unique set of keys such that this set of messages and the set of keys are consistent. That is, if you just add it up, you get the local outputs, if you do it for each station, right? This is what I want to prove. So if in this might be combination of messages, if I assume this is, what is the value of the key? So this is what the station M wants to send. This is the equation how the output is determined. So what is the value of the key K in this case? What is K prime? So we take the output. We subtract the message, which according to this combination of messages might be the message or should be the message station M is sending. And we just subtract it from the output. And that way we calculate the key K prime. And now, we can subtract that value. The attacker has, in some sense, for this combination of messages, determined the corresponding key value. And now we can subtract this key value here. That is, the other keys are defined as in the induction assumption, where the output of the station SL is taken as output OL plus, because here we are subtracting, plus K prime, plus this value. And now within those set of M minus 1 stations, according to what we may assume for the induction step, the set of keys is uniquely determined. We just had to do it for this M station where we had the particular simple situation that it's only one key we have to deal with, which makes this proof, I would argue, mathematically very simple. So maybe we go further and then I repeat it. So what do we have? To reduce our case with M stations to the case with M minus 1 stations, what do? We just calculated what the output would be here, what the key value would be here, and we did subtract, get rid of this key here. And now what is left over is exactly the situation for M minus 1 stations, which means we have done our proof. Okay. If I look into your faces, somehow you feel uneasy. And so maybe we just go back one step. What does this story here tell us? It tells us if you fix the output, whether a message has been sent can be changed by changing the key, right? This is what we do here in the general case. We are simplifying our key graph. As long as only one key has to be considered. And now for the combination of would-be messages, we calculate the corresponding key K prime, which then makes a consistent whole that if this is the message to be sent, instead of MM, we want to send M prime M, then instead of the key K, you have to use the key K prime, which makes a consistent behavior of station M. And then to go to reduce it to the induction assumption, we have to get rid of this key, which means that we take the station SL, this is the station being connected with SM, and just to get rid of the key, we add it up here, the particular value we did determine here. And now we have a set of S stations of the number M minus 1, where we may assume that calculating the keys works because this was the induction assumption. Okay, so this is the argument. And maybe I repeat something I said earlier. If you Now consider some graph. This key can be used to shift a message from here to there. This key can be used to shift it from here to there, etc. And shifting messages is now a kind of language use or use case where I adapt to your assumption it's just one message being sent. But of course, the proof here is much more general because it may be any combination of messages as long as their sum is the global sum. Okay, so what questions do you have? Then I would assume that probably you should have a look at the proof at home and just make sure that you understand two steps. One argument in the proof is if you are telling the attacker key values, we only make the attacker stronger. So maybe this is one fundamental statement. So if by making the attacker stronger, finally you can still prove what you want to prove, and this made your proof simpler, then okay, this might be a good deal, just making the attacker stronger. This is one thing you should really think about. It, in some sense, is a usual attitude. What attackers do we really consider? In the universe, there may be so many attackers. So what attackers do you really consider? What is pretty clear, the attacker you consider, hopefully, should be stronger than any attacker you ever come across in life, right? This is what you hope for. But which attackers do you consider? And I would argue I'm considering attackers where I still can prove the security of my system. But the proof should be really simple. So the strategy of making your attacker stronger is a usual strategy if you do arguments about security. For example, when I gave you an introduction to the DC network, I said, let's assume the attacker is tapping all lines, right? Why did I say that? Why didn't I start with, let's assume the attacker is tapping five lines? Because I hope, even in the situation that the attacker is tapping all lines, I can still do my proofs. In reality, I'm not sure whether we have an attacker who is able to tap all lines. But any attacker tapping lines is covered by the attacker model of having an attacker who taps all lines. So, you see, the strategy of making the attacker stronger than you hope it might be, but of course, still being able to do your security argument against the stronger attacker. So, this is one thing you should sleep about. And it's very fundamental, and it should get a kind of attitude you do. Just as you learn some things at school, you do some arithmetic without really thinking about it. It's something you should do intuitively. So this is one thing. The second thing is that, and now it gets more special, that if we gave the attacker as many key values as we don't need urgently, we'll end up in a key graph which is minimally connected. That is, if you are deleting a further key, the set of stations will be separated in two non-empty sets. And if you have such a key graph, then there's at least one station which only shares one key with one other station. Because if each station has at least two keys, then somehow it has to have a circle, which contradicts the assumption it's a minimal key graph. So this is understanding the step here. We have a station which only shares one key. And this means it only shares keys with one other station. And now, in the proof, we can do the following. We want to show that any combination of messages could have been sent in a way which is consistent with all the outputs. And now we want to prove that this really is the case. And what do? We calculate the key value corresponding to the message value of this particular station we are considering, then subtracting the key or getting rid of that key with respect to the output of the station this particular station is connected with respect to the key. And then in the rest of the stations, we have the situation that it's one station less and only considering the keys exchange between those stations being left over, which has a property according to the induction assumption. So this is then the induction proof. So this overall is the second thing you should think about at home. I would argue that the first thing, that making the attacker stronger, is the more fundamental thing, because it has nothing to do with the DC network. It's just a general attitude in security engineering. So at least this you really should consider. And if you really want to understand the proof of the DC network, then of course you have to consider this kind of induction proof.
So the anonymity of the station SM is guaranteed because we can assume that SM is sent the zeros or the actual message or any other message that corresponds to the message.
Yes. That is, if you look at this set, this message value could be any value because you can, by choosing the other values, correct it, the overall sum, in a sense that it's the sum of all the outputs. This is the only constraint we have to obey. And this means it can have sent any value, which, if I go back, corresponds to here, any value if you are changing the key. Corresponds to here, any message if you are changing the key. So, okay. Do you have questions? Then, please, at home, think about the proof and ask questions next week if you come across questions. My feeling is that this is a kind of proof where you will need a few minutes to really get the feeling you have understood it. Just a side remark, if you have the feeling that thinking in terms of graphs and links is nothing you like, but with sets of linear equations, you have really lots of fun, then read the original publication of David Chaum. Maybe I should go here. So this was the initial slide. Read the original publication of David Chaum. It's in 1988, the long paper. He does a proof for the DC network using the algebraic structure of finite fields. And he handles the case that you have an arbitrary key graph. It's mathematically more complicated, but if you like that kind and don't want to think about key graphs and modify key graphs, then you find here a proof. And if you enjoy that proof, it's fully okay for me. David Chaum's proof needs a little bit more mathematics because he needs fields. In my proof, it's only that we need abelian groups. We need less mathematical structure. But of course, in the proof I presented, I needed arguments about graphs. I needed the argument that if a graph is minimally connected, you can find a station which only shares one key with other stations, which is an argument which may be convincing if you know a little bit about graphs or have a feeling about graphs. But if you don't have that, okay, here you find a proof without working without any knowledge about key graphs. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, then you have here some homework. And now we have to talk about some limits of the DC network. Maybe I should go back to the slide, the first slide. What was the statement? The statement here was the DC network provides anonymity of the sender. And here we did frame it. If stations are connected by keys, the value of which is completely unknown to the attacker, tapping all lines does not give him any information about the sender. So this was a statement about sender anonymity. And this is what we just proved. In explaining the procedure, I told you the global sum is distributed to all the stations. That is, we have broadcast. So this gives recipient anonymity. So if you look at it in a naive way, we are done. We have solved it. We have sender anonymity and we have recipient anonymity. But in some sense, it's not really well balanced. For sender anonymity, we have really a strong procedure. Within the proof, I didn't assume that an attacker is not part of the system, I didn't assume that an attacker is not trying to modify something. The proof for sender anonymity gives us a really strong result. Sender anonymity is there even against modifying attackers. A modifying attacker may prevent a message to be communicated at all, but a modifying attacker could not prevent sender anonymity. But with respect to recipient anonymity, here it's rather weak, because an attacker could intervene and make sure that some stations don't get the overall result or get a modified result. Or an attacker might make sure that a station gets a result later and some other stations get it more early. And then if you get an answer to the message more early, then surely the answer comes from one of the stations which got the message more early. So in some sense, modifying attackers in the DC network might try to attack the recipients. And in interactive communication, usually you are changing your role, being a sender and being a recipient, over and over again. So if sender anonymity is really strong and recipient anonymity is weaker, overall you only get weak anonymity, because you are going to receive and not only you are going to send. So this is a problem we now want to solve. So our problem is, the attacker sends messages only to some users. If he gets an answer, the addressee was among these users. And now, of course, you could repeat that kind of attack. So if you have a kind of longer conversation, and you really want to identify the addressee, you make sure that in the next step, you're sending it to a different set, framing in or zooming in. So how would you do it? Logarithmic search, right? How do you look for a page in a book? If you have no better strategy, you open up it roughly in the middle. You see whether the page you're looking for is before or after. If you haven't a better strategy, you open up in the middle of this half. And after a logarithmic number of steps, you are there, right? This is what you do. Probably you do it a little bit more clever, because if you have a book of 500 pages, and if you are looking for page 100, you are not opening it in the middle, but slightly more in the beginning. But, okay. So, if I have many stations, and if I want to identify a recipient, what might I do? I send my message to half of the stations. If I get a result, nice. Then the next message to the same addressee, I'm sending to one half of the stations, where in the round before got an answer. And so after a logarithmic number of steps, I'm going to identify the recipient. Is this a real threat? I would argue yes. How many human beings do we have on the earth? So roughly 2 to the 33, roughly. Which means if you are in the game of identifying human beings, you need 33 interactions. Or maybe if you are failing somehow, depending on what kind of failures might occur, maybe a station doesn't answer because it doesn't want to answer. So maybe you may use 2 tries instead of 1, testing for 1 set and the other set. So mainly after 60 or 70 tries, you have done it. And now think about interactive protocols, how many steps they have, and then you see, okay, it's a real threat. So someone raised his arm and wanted to ask something. Yes, you.
I'm not sure how this attacker, how powerful it has to be. It seems to me the attacker not only, as before, has to the ability to tap all the lines, but also to disconnect all the lines at will. And it seems to me that this is a much stronger attacker module.
Okay, first, going back to the proof. Assuming the good stations behave according to the protocol, the proofs gives us sender anonymity. Even if a modifying attacker is changing messages. So a modifying attacker could change the outputs of the stations. But he wouldn't learn anything. The proof still would be valid. That is, the first statement I wanted to make is, this proof of sender anonymity is not only a proof, is not only true for an observing attacker, it's also true for a modifying attacker. And therefore, I would be interested, is there a possibility to achieve recipient anonymity, not only in the setting of an observing attacker, where mainly we have to do nothing because we are just going to broadcast, and against an observing attacker, it's enough. But if you want to have recipient anonymity against a modifying attacker, somehow it gets tricky. Because a modifying attacker, as you spelled out, might intervene, might break lines, might defer the transmission on lines, might do everything. And now the question is, a modifying attacker who can do this, realistic? And I would argue on the internet, it might be. Usually your routers can be programmed, so you could modify your routing table, you could skip messages depending who did send it, etc., etc. Usually this is not done in the standard configuration, but it could be done. And if you would be a kind of secret service, being interested who is communicating to whom, if you have no better strategy than having these kinds of delays or dropping some of the messages, then I would assume you would do that. If you look at what secret services do, they do much more risky stuff than that. So, what can we do? This is the first problem. The second problem is, if a user, even a single user in the DC network, misbehaves in the sense that he does not add up his message and all the keys, and gives this as its output. If he misbehaves giving another output, or in the extreme case, giving a random output, what will happen? Let's go to the corresponding slide. If any of these three stations gives a random output, this global sum will be random, which means no message transmission. That is, we have sender anonymity. This is very nice. But each of the senders can completely bring down the network, can completely prevent message transmission by just outputting random values. So this is a kind of duality. If you have anonymity, I would argue, then anybody can bring down the system. And vice versa, if you want to prevent that anybody can bring down the system, then probably you don't have anonymity, because you can keep separate what people do. So surely, a system where everybody can bring down the system is not really a good idea, right? Because why did we start? We started, there might be attackers. There might be people who are interested in who communicates to whom. And of course, they would be willing to intervene. They would be willing to bring down the system if they couldn't break it. So what would happen if you would just use it? Probably the secret services of the world would make sure that they get part of a DC network and just would make sure that no useful message transmission takes place. So at least we need a kind of procedure making sure that if someone does sabotage, we will going to detect that entity. And maybe we then exclude it from the DC network. What probably is not good enough, that if you say, hey, let's do a kind of registration procedure. We register for the DC network, and whoever wants to take part in the DC network, first we are going to ask him, hey, are you really a good guy? Will you never disturb the network, etc.? And only if he says yes, we are going to take him. Okay, this is nonsense. By the way, if you ever did travel to the United States, you get a green sheet of paper where mainly you are asked questions. Are you planning to commit crimes in the United States? Are you a terrorist? And things like that. And, okay, I never understood why they have this sheet of paper, because I would assume that no terrorist is so stupid that he will make the cross, yes, I'm a terrorist. I'm planning to commit crimes. So, okay. So, trying to solve the problem at registration time is not really a solution. So what we need is a solution to problem two. We need to be able to punish entities doing a modifying attack at service delivery. So if messages are corrupted, we need a kind of investigation procedure. Who did it? And then finally, in the long run, we should be able to exclude that entity. But on the other hand, we should be sure that if you are willing to investigate messages because they are corrupted, we have to make sure that never ever we are going to investigate a message which is really a personal message to anybody. So we should be able to investigate, but not messages which are of a personal nature. because for that purpose we wanted to have sender anonymity. And if now, just to prevent attacks on service delivery, we would introduce a protocol which enables us to trace who did what and who did send which message, then mainly we would give away sender anonymity just to achieve availability. So in some sense, this kind of protocol has to be tricky. We should be able, in the long run, to get the bad guys. But we have to make sure that never ever we are going to investigate and trace back to the original sender a message of the good guys. So this sounds somehow tricky, and we are going to do that after the break. So, two problems to be solved. One is making broadcast strong enough against modifying attackers. And the second problem is then making sure if someone is just sending random messages, that is preventing message transmission, that in the long run we are going to catch that person or that entity. So what is the idea to make broadcast more secure? Maybe first, what could we do in principle? Of course, you could say, hey, I'm sending my message, my broadcast, to everyone. Good idea. Maybe you sign the value you distribute. You give it a timestamp. Then, if you are broadcasting or if you're distributing different values, both digitally signed, both with the same timestamp, okay. Users could argue, hey, you are a cheater. So values could be secured by digital signatures. But how do you secure that the messages are really broadcast, that they are really received by the recipients? How to do that? One way is to do it is to ask everybody who should get a message, please send me a receipt. Then it's clear you got it. Fine. If you want to have consistency of the broadcast, that is, either a message is sent to everyone or to no one. No one means all others ignore the message they got. If you want to get receipts by everyone, you stumble across the following problem. Let's assume we discuss it in a person-to-person scenario. Let's assume I want to make sure you got my message. And I only are willing to proceed if I know you got my message. Let's assume you want to have consistency between the two, that we both know you got the message and we are going to proceed, right? This seems to be the elementary problem we have in broadcast as well. Okay. Let's try to solve it. And we'll see that it's really hard, even with two persons. First idea is, I sent you a message. Now if you want to be sure that you got it, I ask you, please send me a reply, a confirmation that you got it. Let's assume I get it, your confirmation. Then I know you got my message. Okay. And now we said, okay, if I know you got my message, and we both know that I know it, then we proceed in the protocol, right? But now what's the problem? You sent me a confirmation that you got it, but you don't know whether I get your confirmation. Your confirmation can be lost. Okay. So I sent you a confirmation for your confirmation. But what's the problem now? I can only proceed if I know that you got my confirmation of your confirmation. Because otherwise, okay. So we see that having consistency in a distributed system is a problem. Because the last message you are sending, you never know whether it made it. With confirmation, you can usually secure the messages before. But the last message somehow is uncertain. And therefore, it's inherently difficult to make sure that we both react in a coordinated fashion. With broadcast, this problem is even more severe. Because what do we want to have? I send you a broadcast message to every one of you. And we are only going to proceed if everybody got it and everybody knows that everybody got it. And everybody knows that everybody knows that everybody got it. Oh, it's a nightmare. So this is a problem. Of course, we could stop it somewhere and say, hey, but if we stop it, people may behave inconsistently. Some will do, some others won't do. Okay. If you read textbooks, I never did so, but I assume there should be textbooks about this problem. What would you expect you'll find in the textbook? Let's start with our elementary problem. We want to have consistent knowledge whether you got my message, and we both know it. I argued that deterministically, we can't solve it, because the last message always is insecure. So what would we do if we would have to solve this problem? Probably, we would say, because a deterministic solution doesn't exist, let's try to do it probabilistically. So, in exchanging messages back and forth, what do we want to do? Make the probability that we both agree larger and larger. It will never be one, but it should get closer to one relatively fast. So a procedure could be that whenever we exchange a message, the party getting the receipt in the step before increases the probability that it will say, okay, yes, it succeeded by a factor of two. That is, first, let's say we are doing it with probability 1/2, then with 3/4, etc., etc. So, of course, there might be a difference between the two of us. 1/2 is not 3/4. 3/4 is not, what's the next step, 7/8, things like that. But 7/8 is closer to 3/4 than 3/4 is to 1/2. So it gets closer and closer if you bootstrap it. But still sounds clumsy. Looks like as we do need a lot of interaction between the two of us. And it's pretty clear if you would do it in a larger group, surely it gets even more inefficient, because it's not only that we two have to coordinate, but all of us have to coordinate. And it's not only necessary that you all coordinate with me, but you have to coordinate with each other. So sounds as if it would cause quite a bit of traffic, right? And now I'm coming back to the DC network and giving you an idea how in the DC network this problem may be solved much more efficiently. And the main idea is the following. Usually in the DC network, we say we have stations, they have exchanged keys, and they are using the keys for sender anonymity, right? Keys have nothing to do with broadcast. Whether broadcast is consistent or inconsistent doesn't change anything with the keys, right? And now the idea is the improvement towards the DC plus network that we should take what we got. We should take the local view on the broadcast. We should take the message we got into key generation. That is, coming back to the example of the two of us, if somehow someone managed that you get another message broadcast than me, and let's assume we have a key in common, so I'm considering now we are connected by the key graph, then you should use the message you got in the round before, and I should use the message I got in the round before to calculate our common key value for the coming round. This would make sure, if we do it clever, that if you got a different value than I got, our common key for the next round will not be of the same value, but of completely different values. Which would mean that in the next round, we too will stop the DC network. If we got the same message broadcast, and if we do the same procedure for generating our common key, depending on the message which was distributed to both of us, then we arrive at the same key and everything works fine. Okay. So the idea is the following. What do we have with sender anonymity? We too know if we have exchanged a key, you are honest, I am honest, then we both cannot be separated by an attacker. We have a shared key. We cannot figure out whether you are sending or I. And hopefully, if you have changed more keys with other people, they are honest as well. We have a larger group. And now, with the broadcast, we are going to have the same procedure. If we both have exchanged a key, if we both take the message we got broadcast into our key generation, then we make sure in the last round we got the same message. Otherwise, we are interrupting the system. Now, if you have exchanged a key with her, and you're doing the same procedure with her with respect to the broadcast, if you and she got different messages, you will bring down the network. Which, even if we didn't exchange a key directly, but you exchanged the key with him, I exchanged the key with him, it gives consistency between the two of us, assuming he is not the cheater. So, what we did at that time, I was at Karlsruhe University, we did put up some formula where we said, okay, this capital K, this is the key we are going to use in the next round. The keys which I exchanged are called A and B, and for each time frame, for each step, we have a different part of the key. The capital C, this is the broadcast character. And now we have to sum up the product of the B and C's for all the past. That is, our sum goes from time frame 1 until time t minus 1. If you are going to calculate the key value for time slot t, which makes sure that I argued about the past message. Of course, I would even better argue not only about the past message, but all past messages, making sure that all the broadcasts in the past have been consistent. So this is the main idea, which means, what do we have to do? Keys to be exchanged have the double length, twice the length. We have to do some multiplications. Okay. And the longer the DC network runs, the slower it gets, because this sum has to be taken over increasing intervals. Now we can improve on that and say, hey, we are not starting with 1, but somehow in the past. If we make sure that during a certain time interval, we are going to send, everyone is going to send. Because how do we check, by the way, that the network is brought down? Maybe I should go back and say, hey, we argued that if we both get inconsistent information via broadcast, we have exchanged the key, we bring down the network in the next step. Which means that whether you react or I on some of the messages, we make sure the next step will not be useful for any message transmission. It will just be garbled. And by the way, it will not only be garbled for the two of us, it will be garbled for everyone taking part in the DC network. So, what is the contrary? The contrary is the DC network runs fine. How do we know it runs fine? An attacker could send it anything to us. So please don't come up with the idea on the DC network, after each round we are transmitting a message, everything is fine. Because the attacker will send a message to everyone, everything is fine. So how can we check that everything is fine and not garbled? And the only good idea I came across is I can check that everything is fine if I want to send a message and it makes it back to me. Because if any of you have inconsistently received something, have Now, inconsistent keys, you will make sure that I can send my message, but I never will get it back because it will be garbled by you. And the attacker cannot undo that you garble my message. So a good test, or the perfect test, whether everything is fine, is making sure you send a message, maybe a random message or whatever, or some end-to-end encrypted message is pretty close to a random message as seen from an attacker's point of view. You send a message and you get it back, broadcast, hopefully broadcast, but at least you get it back, and then it's okay. Then you know the message made it back, the network is not garbled, which tells you that until here, broadcast has been consistent, which gives me an argument that at least you, from now on, can assume I don't have to check all the past, all the time. Until now, I did check that everything worked fine. I don't have to check it over and over again. Now, of course, it's only you who can check it in this round that everything is fine. And this gives us that here somehow we need kind of interval, making sure that within this interval everyone has a possibility to check. And then this sum for calculating the keys we are going to overlay, to superpose, this sum has to go somewhere in the past, but not from the very beginning, which means with this kind of modification, making sure everybody sends in regular intervals, we can prevent that the key generation gets more complex with each round. So now it's constant expense. So we'll later on discuss what do we do if we want to solve problem two. So what do we do if we have to lay open what happened to make sure who did attack? But the first problem now, in some sense, is solved. Why? If I send, or maybe if I get a broadcast, let's argue that way. If I get a message where I want to check that it is broadcast, and we started that a protocol asking you all, did you get the same message? Trying to make sure that we have a consistent decision procedure, whether everybody got the same message. This is really complex. But here, with this formula, you just make sure that whenever you have exchanged a key with someone, by this procedure for key generation, implicitly you check that you got the same message in the past broadcasts. Because if not, you are bringing down the network. Why is this a kind of fail-safe procedure? If the attacker is not causing an inconsistency within the set of stations which are honest, which follow the protocol, then there's not a problem. Then the attacker behaves inconsistent between his stations and the rest of the world. this is not really much of a threat. But if he distributes a message inconsistently between the set of stations of CTC network, from then on, this network will be essentially stopped. It will just output random data. Will everybody know at the same moment that this network is stopped? By the way, this was what made our protocol so difficult, that I send you a message, you reply, I give a confirmation to your reply. The problem is that you want to know it at once, whether you got the message, because you wanted to make our next step dependent on whether you got it or not. This was a problem we had. And here, now with the solution of the DC Plus network, if not, everybody gets the insight that the network is stopped at the same moment, it's a fail-safe procedure. Even if some people for some time try to send messages, the messages won't make it. They will just be garbled. So one trick of the DC Plus network is that we get out of the trap that we want to decide it at the same time. We want to know it in the same step consistently. If some people don't understand it at the same time, okay, they will try for some time to send messages, and their messages won't make it. And sooner or later, hopefully, they will understand that there is a problem. And maybe if we want absolutely to be on the safe side, then if we know that there is a problem, what do? We will just make sure everybody gets to know there is a problem. One possibility would be send a message to everyone. Hey, there's a problem. Okay, nice procedure. Other procedure would be just to make sure that the problem takes so long that everybody in the meantime tried to send a message of its own. Then you will see it's not succeeding. His or her message doesn't make it. And now he or she should know, hey, we have a problem. Okay, so sooner or later we will know all that there is a problem. Great. What do we do next? Okay, two ways. Of course, if you had a problem, one way is to investigate what the problem was, who caused the problem, etc., etc. We're going to discuss that later. And if you know we had a problem, some people will even know when it started, then we could say, hey, in this round, we got an inconsistency. All the next rounds have been disturbed. So please ignore all those rounds where we had an inconsistency. Clear your memory and proceed. And of course, start with a consistent set of keys. Or take your keys, the next part of your keys, but take a consistent input for this round where we had the inconsistency. Another strategy would be to say, hey, if the inconsistency means two different values have been distributed, then make sure both values are distributed. So in any case, make sure everyone has the same perception of the situation, which means that the attacker didn't succeed in giving some information here and a different information there, having then a possibility to make a distinction between the two sets of participants. Okay. So this was problem one. And I should say that the procedure I just sketched, to my belief, is really a groundbreaking procedure for consistency in distributed systems. Because usually all you can achieve is getting some kind of probabilistic agreement by some iteration of steps, getting probabilities close to one. Here in this procedure, we have much, much better probabilities. Or as long as it works fine, we don't need any additional messages. We are just doing the stuff we want to do. And implicitly, we are certain that we have consistency. So in some sense, consistency is for free as far as transmission is concerned. Of course, consistency is not for free as far as calculation of keys is concerned. There we have to do some work. Okay, questions so far? Okay. Then we come to the next problem, how to trap and trace entities who try to bring down the network on purpose, who try to jam the network, who just try to prevent message transmission. And the main idea here is that we have a larger frame. Let's assume we have n users. Then we will have 2n reservations. And if this works out fine, we'll have a 2n collision-free message transmissions. Let's assume we agree on the following rules. Any of the n users will try to reserve 2 slots, therefore 2 times n. One of the slots will be a trap. A trap means you will send some garbage, at least no personal information of you, send something, maybe garbage. And if an attacker is unlucky enough to disturb the slot where you have laid a trap, then you can say, hey, I've got it. You have stumbled into my trap. Now I'm going to ask everybody, please let's investigate who did bring down the network in this time frame, in this trap. Of course, we need a procedure how you can convince others that this was a trap. Because otherwise, an attacker could say, hey, this time slot I want to be investigated. This was a trap, but in reality it wasn't. And then the attacker could cause that way that personal information is investigated. So the first idea you have to have is that if you are going to lay traps, there should be a procedure to prove that some time slot really was a trap. The second time frame, usually, each user takes for sending personal messages. And of course, these personal messages no user wants to be investigated. Therefore, if an attacker is lucky enough to disturb the slot with the useful message, then probably nobody will stand up and say, let's investigate. But if an attacker is going to disturb a slot, the probability that it will fall into a trap, into someone's trap, will be one half. And therefore, if you do it on a kind of regular basis, sooner or later, you will fall into a trap. It will be investigated, and we'll see how this works. We'll see how what happens. So this is the idea of traps, and this is the idea of non-traps. Okay. Now, why do we have a kind of reservation and then collision-free message sending? Why do we do it that way? Until here, during the reservation phase, no personal information makes it into the protocol. Why? Every user behaves exactly in the same way. Every user tries to reserve two slots. One is trap, and one is non-trap. So what can we do until here? We can, whenever some user has the feeling, hey, someone did disturb me, any user until here can say, please, we want to investigate all the reservations, because no personal information is involved. So we can do that. If this investigation of all the reservations reveals an attack, then let's try to punish the attacker. If the investigation of all the reservations reveals nothing, then the person causing the investigation probably is the attacker. Because you can do a denial of service attack in two ways. One is that you just send wrong bits, bringing down the network. And the other way to attack is sending always here the information, hey, I want to investigate the reservation phase. Which means that if you just adhere to that request, you never ever get into the phase of ever sending a useful message, which is a denial of service attack as well. So it should be clear, if someone says, I want to have an investigation, the investigation either reveals some misbehavior of someone, or requiring an investigation is misbehavior. And then the entity requiring the investigation should be punished. Okay. Now let's assume we made it until here, and nobody requires an investigation. Then we know everyone succeeded in reserving two slots. By the way, for this reservation phase, you can take the protocol we had. So for the reservation phase, you can take this protocol. Everybody sends a message, and this message, the sequence of this message, gives you the sequence you are later on enabled to send. So this protocol of global superposed receiving can be the protocol for doing the reservations. And by the way, come back to that, that in this protocol you already sent some smaller messages. We'll need that later. Now we send collision-free messages. Collision-free means if everybody behaves well, then it's collision-free. Of course, if a modifying attacker misbehaves, then it won't be collision-free. And now, if something goes wrong, users may decide whether they request tracing for any of these messages, who did send what, to check who behaved according to the protocol and who misbehaved. In order to trigger an investigation, let's say in this time slot, 2, the party requesting that investigation has to prove that time slot 2 here has been reserved and has been reserved as a trap. What can we do to prove that something was reserved as a trap? Now there is a kind of cryptographic protocol which is called bit commitment scheme, or some people call it blobs. And it's the idea is that you output some bit string called bit commitment. For those seeing it, it looks random. At least they don't see whether it's a commitment for 0 or 1. And later on, you can open it. If you made it, you can open it and prove whether you committed a 0 or a 1. Maybe I do it physically. How to do it? Let's assume you are not in the room at the moment, and I am committing to something. Maybe, sure, this is a 1, right? Now you are allowed to enter the room, okay? Now you are here. I can tell you, hey, I committed either to 0 or 1. I cannot change my commitment, because if you know the rules of the game, that it has to be on the blackboard. And it's my decision, assuming I am in control of the blackboard and not you, when I open it, and I can just open it and say, okay, here you see, it's a 1. This is a physical implementation of a bit commitment scheme. I give you another implementation, just as simple as possible. I don't say that it's efficient. There are better ones. But conceptually, the most simple thing to do it with cryptography is, let's assume I'm using a public key encryption scheme. So I published a public key. Let's assume my public key encryption scheme is probabilistic. That is, even if I'm encrypting the same plain text, because it's randomized, it will yield different ciphertext with overwhelming probability. then a bit commitment scheme could be that I'm encrypting either 1 or 0 probabilistically. And the outcome, the ciphertext, is public. It stands on the blackboard, right? Readable by everyone. And now, how could I open it? If, for example, we would use RSA, and probabilistic encryption would mean that a random number is just encrypted together with the plain text, I could open my commitment in just telling you the random number I used for the probabilistic encryption. Right? Clear in your head, or should I go back to the presentation where we had RSA? So I hope you have it in your mind. So, why is this secure? The general construction with the asymmetric encryption system. There are two properties I have to prove. First is, I can't open it differently. Okay, there you have the uniqueness of the decryption. And secondly, I should argue that if you just see the ciphertext, you don't get the message which is encrypted. So this is a classical security property of the encryption system. And, for example, in the case of RSA, it's enough to know the encryption routine, to know whether it's 0 or 1, or otherwise you try both possibilities, and to have the random number which makes encryption probabilistic. And then everybody can check. So this would be one implementation of a bit commitment scheme. And maybe I should go back to this slide. In my example, the ciphertext of the asymmetric probabilistic encryption scheme could be the bit string which is in these slots. That is, in the reservation phase, the bit commitment is really tied to the slot. That is, if later on I say, hey, I want to open it here, slot 2, I want to open slot 2, and I want you all to help me in investigating slot 2, then I have to convince you that it's really a trap. You all know from the reservation phase what have been the bits here for the reservation. What was the example? The RSA ciphertext. Then I tell you, hey, this was really, let's say, a 1. A 1 means a trap. And I tell you, and this was the random number for probabilistic encryption. So you can all check whether it really was a trap. If it was a trap, the protocols tells you, you should help me investigate it. If it's not a trap, you should say, hey, Mr. Fitzman, you are a cheater. You want to trick us into helping you investigate in something which might be a very personal message of someone else. So we won't help you. And even better, we should punish you because you're making a lot of fuss for some kind of investigation that this is a trap and it isn't. So you are the bad guy. You're going to be punished. So this is how this protocol works, or the idea behind the protocol. And here on the slide, I don't comment it in detail. You have more efficient ways to do bit commitments than using an asymmetric encryption system. But I think the asymmetric encryption system is the most simple way to understand it. Maybe I should, at the abstract level, go even a little bit deeper. How secure is a bit commitment? Let's start with the physical one. How secure is this? Obviously, if you see that I can't change something on the blackboard, then it's absolutely impossible that a one gets a zero or vice versa. So this property, I call it an integrity property. This obviously is as good as the blackboard just keeps the characters I write on them. Assuming my handwriting is roughly okay. So, is this a zero? How close do I have to, okay. But if the handwriting is okay, everything is fine. With integrity, assuming we haven't a kind of active blackboard. How good is secrecy? In our physical example, probably so good as, first, you can't look through the first blackboard, and secondly, there's no mirror or something like that that you somehow can look into that. But in any case, there are two distinct security properties, integrity and confidentiality. Now let's come back to the bit commitment scheme implemented using the asymmetric encryption system. How about the security properties? The integrity of the bit commitment is absolute because decryption is unique. Decryption is guaranteed. The secrecy, the confidentiality property, is only computational. Why? If an attacker can do enough calculations, he can just try out all the random numbers and see which one fits. So if you don't speak about bit commitments in the physical world, but in cryptography, usually in bit commitments, either integrity or confidentiality can be unconditional, can be provided without computational assumptions. And the other property then depends on computational assumptions. And if you look at different variants, it's nice to note, but I won't make it in this lecture. I don't ask it in oral examinations. It's interesting to know that you can have bit commitments which have integrity, absolutely, and compromise somehow on confidentiality, and you can have it vice versa. You can have absolute confidentiality, but then you do some kind of compromise in the area of integrity. Okay, so far the bit commitments. And now I have to discuss what do we do if we have modifying attacks, and if you are going to investigate. So what might happen and what to do? Modifying attacks could try to undermine sender anonymity, but there would argue no chance. They could, if you don't use the DC plus network, try to attack recipient anonymity. And in any case, modifying attack can be attacks on service delivery. They can bring down the network. They can prevent message transmission. How? An attacker could always send a message character unequal zero, even if he is not entitled to send. He could send a random number, and this yields no transmission of meaningful information. So what to do? If we have a modifying attack at the service delivery, corrupted messages are investigated, and additionally we check that it's a trap, just to make sure that we don't trace messages which transport personal information. How do we check? We have to check in principle that each station behaved as it should. And to check that, you have to know for each station all the keys that station shares with others. Of course, not the whole key, but the part of the key which is used for the slot we are just going to investigate. Then you have to know what was the output of the station. You have to know, if you're doing the DC plus network, all the global superposing results received by the station. And you have to know at what time the station may send message characters according to the multi-access protocol. So what to do if you want to investigate? So first, the first three items you are just asking. You are asking a station, please tell me the keys you are using. Please tell me your output. Please tell me what you got in the last rounds via broadcast. And having that information, I can calculate which message character this station did send, because I know the sum of all keys plus the message service, message character should be the output of the station. And if I have the keys which are exchanged, if I have the global superposing results, then even if I'm using the DC plus network, I can calculate the keys to be used in that slot. So if I managed to calculate the message character which the station tried to send, then of course I can investigate and can compare whether, according to the multi-access protocol, this station was allowed to send this message character. So I can check by comparing what I calculated here and what, according to the multi-access protocol, would be allowed, whether the station behaved well. What is pretty clear, if all the stations behaved well, and if broadcast was consistent, then everything would be fine. No disturbance in the network, right? So in some sense, if something is disturbed, either some station misbehaved or the network didn't function, the transmission network didn't function as it should. In the following, I won't discuss how to check whether the transmission network functioned as it should, because, okay, this is some kind of standard procedure. I have to admit it's difficult, because how do you make sure how the bit changed if the, okay. So let's ignore for the moment the transmission network with the additional remark, if you don't trust the transmission network, sign everything you sent. And each recipient should test whether what it got is signed correctly. Because the output of the stations are public, no problem in signing your output before you send it. This way, you can make sure that it's not the transmission network which brings down the DC plus network. So now let's focus on the stations. So we are checking all the stations. And what might happen? Of course, if some stations are pretty stupid, or at least if one station is pretty stupid, she might give you key values, an output value, global superposition results, such that obviously it has sent a character, a non-zero character, in a situation it shouldn't. Then it's really easy to decide. Then you say, hey, and this station did send when it shouldn't. It misbehaved. So what would you do? Exclude it from the network, right? Because it brought down the network by sending something when it shouldn't. So let's exclude it. Of course, when you are asked these kinds of questions, you know, if you're giving some answers, you will be excluded. So if you are clever, probably you will never give that answers. But somehow, something went wrong. Some misbehavior took place. So what could be the reason and how could we detect it? So probably each station will give you a set of answers which is consistent in itself. Otherwise, the station will be thrown out of the network. So you get answers which are consistent in itself, consistent in themselves. And now you check whether there's consistency between the different sets of answers. So for example, if you give your set of parameters, I give my set of parameters, and we both agree we have shared a key, probably our key value we give should be the same. If you say you exchanged with me a different key, then I said I exchanged with you, and now I'm not talking about mod 16, so, okay. Then, if we say we share a key, but we have different values, then what do we know? At least one of the two of us is a kind of attacker, is somehow misbehaving. Of course, we don't know who. Could be you, could be me. But we know one of us is a bad guy. What would we do? Or what would you do as an audience? How would you argue? Please don't say, now we are going to throw them out both. Because then we are sure we are throwing out a bad guy. Maybe you are losing a good guy as well, but let's have fun and throw out the bad guy. I would say I could understand that emotionally, but it's not really fair, right? A better procedure is to say, hey, if at least one of the two of you is misbehaving, then you shouldn't share a key. Because if one of the two of you is part of the attacker, exchanging a key with the attacker doesn't make much sense. So if you as a group decide those two guys shouldn't share a key, you're not taking away anything from the good guy. Because sharing a key with the attacker doesn't make much sense. So what is pretty clear is if we are inconsistent with respect to how we talk about keys, we will lose the key we share. And this is the usual outcome if someone is attacking. Let's assume I'm the bad guy. I'm trying to bring down the network. Of course, I will always, when we have some kind of investigation, give you a consistent set of why I behaved that way. But if I have shared keys with you, I have to lie at least about one key value. So some other entity will say, hey, we have a different key. So in each investigation, as the bad guy, I'm losing a key. Which means after a finite number of investigations, I will not have a shared key with anyone. Which means now it's pretty clear I don't get anonymity in taking part, so you can throw me out of the network without I am losing anything. Now let's assume an attacker has not only one station, but several stations. Of course, he could start lying between the station he has. But then he's losing keys between them. And sooner or later, he has no keys anymore between his stations. Then he is losing keys shared with others, and in the end, the attacker won't have any keys. And then you can throw out the stations. So the bottom line of this kind of procedure is, if someone is going to cheat, and this is investigated, then either the entity is so stupid that he says, okay, I was the cause of all the trouble, you may throw me out. Or he will have a conflict with someone else. And in case of conflict, it comes down to delete keys. And if stations don't share keys, if stations are not connected by keys, then they don't have sender anonymity, so you can put them into different DC networks. Which at the end of the day means that the attacker is running his own DC network, and there he may do whatever he likes, and the good guys have their DC network without the attacker as well. Without investigating any message which has personal nature. Because we had these blobs, these bit commitment schemes, which helped together with the procedure here, with the reservation, to make sure that no really sensible messages ever are investigated. So this was the idea how to counter modifying attacks. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, maybe I don't understand completely how this reservation of traps is working, but I'm thinking of the following possible attack. What could you say about it? I'm reserving two spots how I should, and I'm behaving as everything should be, and when I come across a collision with one of my spots and a message where I would like to know who sent it, I then start an investigation. After that investigation, I maybe crossed out from the network because there was not really a crash or something, but then I know who sent the message, and that's all I wanted to know.
Okay, so in this picture, it means here at the end of the collision-free message sending phase, you say, I want, for example, slot 2 investigated, right? Because in slot 2, I saw a message where I'm interested in the sender, right? Now, you need the cooperation of the whole group to investigate that. So you have to convince them that this slot was a trap. That is, you have to open the corresponding blob, which is published here as a 1, which, if it's not your slot, you can't, because you cannot open other guys' blobs. This doesn't change, because here we made sure that within the reservation blobs there wasn't any collision, or it worked out fine. So here we stop and say, everything okay? If yes, then we proceed. So all disturbances which can now occur, occur here, but this is commonly known by everyone. And therefore, whatever you want to do, if you want to have an investigation here, everybody knows that this is the bit commitment you have to open. And if you can't do that, you won't get cooperation. Okay? So, in some sense, I commit, or I admit, that this is a complicated protocol. So I would encourage you at home to rethink it. And if you come across questions, then please ask them. Maybe you send an email. You know we have this email distribution list. Or you ask them next week. So, maybe this slide helps you a little bit. So, collisions in the reservation phase, we cannot avoid them completely. Why? I gave you the example that for the reservation, I would use something like this. And what now means a collision? It would mean that those values here are not disjoint. It would mean that two of those values, or even more, have the same value, which would mean that the reservation phase wouldn't be successful because we couldn't bring it in a proper order. But of course, the probability that this happens is rather low, because if those message values are chosen randomly, the probability that two independently chosen messages are the same is really small. So if this happens, you can't treat it as an attack. What you should do is say, hey, if bad luck, either we redo it, whole reservations redone, or if it happens too often, then those who have the same value just can't participate in that round. Because, of course, if an attacker has several stations, the attacker, of course, always can use for his stations the same value, pretending that there's some kind of collision. What is more risky is that the attacker could wait, the attacker A could wait, await the output of the users, truthful to the protocol, and then A could choose his own message so that a collision is generated. So the attacker waits until some users commit to a bit string, and then he copies the bit string and generates a collision that way. And the solution is, don't do the reservation directly. Reapply the principle of commitments. That is, first commit to everything you want to do, and after everyone did commit, then open the commitments, and then it gets real. In such a way, the commitments make sure that everyone committed, so nobody can adapt to what others output. Okay, this is the solution here. So maybe we stop here. I have no additional homework for you. All the exercises are still valid. It's up to you what you do.